Welcome to Radio Aldi, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. I'm Charlotte Metcalf, and today I'm delighted to be in conversation with the distinguished journalist and arts administrator and now fellow podcaster, John Tusa. During the 80s, John Tusa was the main presenter on BBC Two's Newsnight for 6 years and then managing director of the BBC's World Service. He went on after that to be MD of the Barbican Arts Centre, and he's also particularly well known for chairing or serving on more boards than you can shake a stick at, from the European Youth Orchestra to British Architecture Trust Board and Wigmore Hall. John Tusa, a very warm welcome to Radio Aldi.
I'm delighted to be with you and with all fellow Aldis.
Yes, there's a lot of fellow Aldis. Now, before we get on to talking about you and your full and varied career, we're going to start with talking about your new podcast, The Best Is Yet to Come, which necessitates me telling our listeners that you are 90 years old.
That's right. I'm jolly lucky and very proud of it, but above all, lucky.
Because a unique selling point of your new podcast, The Best Is Yet to Come, is that all your guests are also 90. Now, you kicked off this series of podcasts with your godson, Rory Stewart, doing a lengthy and comprehensive interview with you about your life. So I'm feeling a little bit apprehensive about finding anything new to say.
I wouldn't.
But let's start by telling our listeners who haven't heard that interview, why? What made you want to do this?
I met a couple at a supper party who I really got on with very, very well. I liked them a lot. One of them at that time was 88, the wife. Husband was 91. And I met them and got to become friends. And I thought they're two of the most attractive, intelligent people. And somehow this must have fed into an idea of how wonderful these 90-year-olds are. And then I started to think, or I started to notice how many people I know are in their 90s and what wonderful people they are. And I wanted to hear and tell their stories. And by the by, one of the wonderful things in the podcast that I'm working on, the people I'm working on are young enough to be my grandchildren. And they're wonderful.
And so tell our listeners a bit about who you've interviewed so far. The most recent, I think, was Lady Antonia Fraser, who's, of course, a great favourite with the oldie.
I interviewed Antonia Fraser, and she was extraordinarily interesting, of course, about Harold Pinter. I asked her what it was like, and would her marriage have survived in today's
tabloid
social media?
Comment.
Yes. Mm. And she said, well, in any case, you know, there was a huge amount of stuff, a lot of anti-Semitism, incidentally, about Harold. And she said, you know, we were happy, we had a fantastic marriage, and I think they ignored quite a lot of it. So she thought that they would have survived. And she also told me about the day that her father, Lord Longford, the prison reformer, came to her and said, I've had another letter from Myra Hindley, the Moor's murderer, who he wrote to regularly because he thought that she should be paroled or should be considered for parole. And whenever he said, I've had a letter from Myra, would you like to read it? Antonia always said, no, I wouldn't. And then on this occasion, her father said, I've had a letter from Myra, I think you should read it. So she did. And in it, Myra Hindley said that she had recently read Antonia's biography of Mary, Queen of Scots.
Did that sway Antonia's mind?
Yeah, no. And for, anyway, fortunately, Myra Hindley disliked it.
That's very funny. So and who else have you interviewed? Fascinating people.
Interviewed Richard Layard, who is an economics professor at the London School of Economics. At the age of 92, he's still advising the government. And Richard's great discovery, so to say, was he said, why do governments do what they do? He said, they should be interested in whether people are happy or not. And they said, you're an economist, you're not a psychologist. He said, no. Happiness is or ought to be an economic measure. and we'll work out ways of measuring it. And governments ought to pay attention. And if it turns out that the things they're doing are not making people happy, then perhaps they should rethink their policies. And so Richard has been doing this, I forget for how long, but, you know, many, many years. And there's a happiness index, and governments can do it and can use it. Whether they pay attention to it is another matter. And I think there are 11 elements in it. I said to Richard, I said, where do you put yourself on the happiness index? He said, I put myself at 8 out of 10. And I think that's pretty good. And if you're lucky, and I recognise lots of people aren't, by the by, I think that's a wonderful thing to have somebody age 92 saying, I am 8 out of 10 happy. And you if that's where you are, you accept it with gratitude, don't you?
I think that's really interesting, because I remember Max Hastings, funny enough, writing a very good piece a long time ago about greed and how once you worked out what you like doing in life and could just about pay for it, the rest can go to hell. It doesn't matter. Yeah. And I think, unfortunately, we are in a society now where the, you know, whatever they're called, the ultra-high net worths, have all gone a bit bonkers because they think they need another yacht or a nuclear bunker. Yes.
Fortunately, the likes of you and me can't even begin to imagine feeling that you need a yacht, never mind.
Well, not making podcasts, we don't.
Yes. No.
Oh, interesting. And then you interviewed a child psychiatrist, didn't you?
Yes, Philip Graham. Philip's 93. He's just finished a book called 65 Years of Childhood in the UK. And he's got really interested in this because of his own family background. It was rather strange and rather restricted one. And so he thought, I'm going to study how children behave. So I said, is there more psychological unhappiness among children?
And today, as opposed to sort of 30 years ago.
That's right. And he said, I'm not sure that there is, but of course there's more diagnosis.
Yes, labels.
And sometimes, of course, there can be over-diagnosis. Mm. And once people are labelled, for good or bad, they say, well, if I've got this, I need treatment. I deserve treatment.
And I'd better play up to it.
And all those things. So it's a rather complex situation. But he also said, I was at the university, and the university authorities said that 50% of the students had some sort of psychological malaise. He said, that's got to be wrong. Mm. That really, really has got to be wrong. We need to think much harder about why is there so much apparent, some it's real, but apparent psychological malaise. Mm. And are we actually beginning to address it in the right way? So all that is emerging, and you know, I'm learning from it. I love talking to these people.
So let's go back to you now, because I was very excited to read about your father, who I mean, I know he brought you here from three days before the Germans invaded Czechoslovakia?
A few weeks.
You got out.
Yes,
and
yes.
He had barter shoes. Yes. I'm mad about barter shoes because I spent a lot of time in Africa, and it's you cannot wear anything else.
No.
I think.
I mean, barter means shoes.
Yes.
Yes.
So tell us about that, because did he not move it all to Essex, to Tilbury?
Yes.
Yes.
And my father was sent over in about the middle of 1939 to run the British Barter Shoe Company, because the founder regarded him as a bright young man, which he was. And, you know, it's one of the things that I never really asked my father, but that at the age of 30, he was sent over from Czechia to England to run a start-up company at the beginning of war, because it had only been going about, Barter had only been going about 10 years in the UK.
And so he wasn't fleeing. You weren't fleeing. He
was sick. The thing was that it then took a while for the family, us, to be given visas by the British government. And at one stage, my father had to threaten and said, if you're not interested enough in bringing my family over from Czechia, I'm going back to Czechia. I mean, God knows, what a thing to have to say. Anyway, that didn't happen. But at age 30, he was then running a company with 3,000 people, and the war was starting, and there was no business in the high streets. And I never really asked him. I never said, you know, Dad, that must have been incredibly difficult. It obviously was.
And you had quite a difficult childhood because you got sent off to boarding school at six.
I was sent off to boarding school at six and a half, yes. And in those days, and the boarding school itself, which was a Cambridge boarding school, we lived in southeast Essex, but the boarding school was sent off to South Devon because that was supposed to be safer. So that was about 4 hours from Paddington, and you didn't see your parents for 6 or 7 weeks. In fact, they usually didn't come down for half term, whatever half term was, you know, because petrol, there's petrol rationing and yes. things. So on the whole, you were often away from home for 13 weeks. And this was quite difficult. I was nearly expelled, actually, very early on. Age, I think, about seven and a half, because I was so miserable. I don't want to make this a misery memoir. I was so miserable that I used to wet my bed.
Oh.
And the headmaster said to my father, unless I stopped wetting my bed, I would be expelled. I survived.
You survived.
But I said, sometimes I left home at six and a half. Because prep school, 6 to 13,
yep.
Public school, 13 to 18, national service, 18 to 20, university, 20 to 24, and then I got married.
So how long were you in the armed forces for?
2 years. Everybody was doing two years by then, and I had 18 months of that in Germany, which was absolutely wonderful. Really, really wonderful, because there was no threat. I mean, you know, I said to people, do you realise in 1955 we would do a regular patrol of the east-west zonal border? And all there was between the British zone and the Soviet zone was a rusty fence. And we drove along this agricultural track. And you could wander over, if you wanted, to the Soviet zone. And there were various watchtowers. We never saw them with guards in them. And, of course, before the wall went up, so when we went to Berlin, we could walk through the Brandenburg Gate in uniform, walk down the Unter den Linden, etc. It was so, really, it was so normal in so many ways. But I saw a lot of West Germany, saw a lot of opera, and it was a wonderful. I mean, a lot of it was very boring. I mustn't make it rosier than it was. And we did think the national service was a waste of time. But in retrospect, I think we can say it was an important part of growing up. And in the meantime, the things we saw and did in West Germany were fantastic.
So Just thinking, do you think it would be a good idea to have national service now?
Not in the form that took place then, and I don't think that the armed services would benefit from it, but I think some sort of universally accepted public service, which could be defined in many ways. Mm. And you might actually find that quite a lot of people would sign up for
yes.
This, and in fact, somebody suggested to me that if the government said to university students, university graduates, if you sign up for the armed services for, let's say, 3 years, mm-hmm. you will write off 30% of your student loan.
They'd be flooded.
They would be flooded. And they said, if you sign up for 5 years, it'll be fine. Something like that. Not for me to work out what it is, but that as a proposition, there would be no problem with recruitment. And by the way, one of the things that the Army was very good at was the Army Education Corps finding out who was still not functionally literate and then making them, Yes, they did.
It's because I remember you talked to Rory on that podcast about the huge difference between the officer class and the rest. And they really were, a lot of people really were genuinely couldn't read and write.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And also, there was a physical difference. I have, and bear in mind, it's 1954, only 1954, and I have a photograph of myself with three of my fellow squaddies in very basic training, the very first 2 weeks. And I am at least 4 to 5 inches taller than all three of them. And it wasn't that I'm particularly tall, because I'm not, but they were, this was the English working class, and it was significantly smaller. You know, that was quite a thing as well, and less well educated. And there were some of the lads in the barrack room who cried at night because they'd never left home before. Mm. Whereas the public school boys,
it's about your seventh home by then.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then you went to Cambridge, and then BBC. Did you go?
Sent to the BBC. Yes.
And what made you want to do that?
I think I had a very idealistic view of how wonderful the BBC was. And it is. It is. But it was very, very starry-eyed indeed. But that's fine. I think you're allowed to be starry-eyed at 24.
So you moved very quickly up the ranks, didn't you? What?
No, not particularly. No. I went to the BBC World Service. I became a producer, then a senior producer. But I looked ahead and I thought, this is all going to be very slow and rather boring. You know, 6 or 7 years doing this and then become an assistant head of a department and then head of a department and this, that, the other. And I really didn't fancy that. And I had something else that I could go to. And so after 6 years in the BBC, I said, I'm going to resign. And people were shocked. And they said, you're resigning from the BBC? And I said, yes. And some people said, but you've got a pension. And that also made me think, if people are only thinking about the fact, you know, I was 30 then, that the important thing is that you have a pensionable job and you shouldn't leave it, there is something wrong about this. And so I became a freelance, and it was the best thing I ever did.
But you had quite a lot of visibility, didn't you, because you were, because of Newsnight.
That was when things started to change. 1979, 1980. Absolutely. You know, because that was a new programme, new ideas, with a wonderful group of people, and Peter Snow leading the, particularly the studio side, and Charles Wheeler and Vincent Hanna and things. I mean, it was an absolutely superb team. And the whole basis of the programme was, we want ideas, there are no rules, so long as it's entertaining, well, entertaining and serious, go ahead and do it, because nobody's going to say you shouldn't do that because you're breaking the rules. And it was a wonderful 6 years, and almost everybody who was on the editorial side then went on to be managing director of this or controller of that. I mean, it was a real training ground for the next generation of senior executives in broadcasting as a whole. It was wonderful.
But you then went on to the World Service.
Yes. The reason I got the job, because after I had no experience of management or anything, or even editing at all. But by the time I applied, there was a chairman of the BBC called Stuart Young, who was quite a radical figure. And he was fed up with the fact that, as far as he could see, the people who took the senior jobs, that there was a sort of merry-go-round of people. First you did one managing directorship, then you did another, then you did another. And to Stuart Young, this seemed rather sterile, and you weren't getting anywhere. So he was looking for somebody who broke that circle. And my great advantage, of course, was that I knew the World Service inside out, because I'd started working there in 1960 and had never lost touch with it. And that was my unique selling point.
I seem to remember, just from you know, listening to you over the years, and also I think when you talked to Ed and me, you had such a sort of profound belief in its ongoing excellence and its role in the world and what it did. And you know, I remember being in Afghanistan and seeing, you know, this sort of Mujahideen absolutely glued to find out what was going on. So you must have been very upset when all the cuts started happening.
Well, I think it's a disaster. And the failure to understand how essential the provision of information is to people in closed societies. It's probably even more necessary now than it was then, and for heaven's sake, it is so necessary now. We have the greatest international broadcasting asset anywhere in the world. Mm. And what do we do? We did not invest in it, and indeed, it has then been cut back. And that is, I was going to say it's a tragedy. It's worse than a tragedy. It's an it's a scandalous piece of political mismanagement.
It was so trusted.
Yes.
And why do you think that was? It's not just a matter of excellent quality. Mm. What really constituted that trust, do you think? Why was it so feared?
The fact that it was reliable over time.
Ah.
And that people could test what they heard and what was the World Service was saying against their own experience.
Yes.
So you couldn't fool them. One of the great World Service correspondents, Anatole Goldberg, who's Russian and he broadcast mm-hmm. to the Soviet Union, and he said, you must never tell the Russians how awful their society is, how beastly it is, how corrupt it is, etc., etc. You know, don't spend your time telling them that they live in a pigsty. They know that. He said, what they want to know is what is really happening, and then they can measure what they hear, and they can test what they hear against what then happens, and they measure that against their own daily experience. I've sometimes asked, I said, surely you want to change people's minds in the Soviet Union? I said, no, I don't. I said, why not? I said, because I think, it's an insult. I said, give people the information as well as you can, as good as you can, and then leave them to use it as they wish. That's the point, and that seems to me the liberal proposition, which I believed in then, and I certainly believe in now.
I'm really interested to know what you think about Steve Rosenberg.
I think he's a fantastic journalist, and he does an incredible job in well-nigh difficult circumstances.
Yes.
And he walks on a tightrope.
Indeed.
the whole time. And he knows exactly where he can place his feet. I think it is a major, major achievement.
Do you think, as a society in general, Britain particularly, is very dismissive of age, constantly chasing, you know, the youth vote, the youth popularity, and we don't value, like, if you like, you know, an African village does say, you know, we don't have groups of elders who are really providing the wisdom and the direction for people. Could we do with much more of that?
It'd be very interesting, and I'd love to see somebody try it. Let's say the BBC was run in a way it had, you know, a non-executive board and executive board, but it then had call it an advisory council, mm-hmm. where you deliberately used people who have the experience and who are considerably more senior.
Yeah.
And who can sit back and when asked about a particular crisis, you know, they can say very often, well, we saw quite a lot of that in my time and this is what happened and this is what you might think of doing. Or they might just say, this doesn't feel like an existential crisis, this is a bit of froth, so don't overreact. So, hold on, yeah, the BBC should have a council of elders where nobody is under, should we say, 80?
I love it. So who are you going to interview next?
I have got Penelope Lively is going to do it.
Mm.
Michael Heseltine is going to do it. Milena Grenfell-Baines, who was on the Kinder transport.
Goodness.
Yeah. She is going to do it, and then I have just a wonderful list of people. I can't wait. And one of the ones I've interviewed very recently, it hasn't gone out yet, is Lillian Hochhauser. Lillian and her husband, Victor, were the music impresarios of their day. 80s, 90s, beyond. And above all, they brought over every Soviet artist, musical and dance of the time. If the Bolshoi came, it was the Hochhausers. If the Marins came, it's the Hochhausers. If Richter came, if Heifetz came, all these people. It was the Hochhausers. Lillian's 99 now. And and to have negotiated this with the Soviet Union, I mean, what an achievement. She's the most wonderful, wonderful person.
Talking of music, are you still very involved in the music world, having run the Barbican? And I mean, not that the Barbican's just about music, it's much bigger than that.
I am occasionally involved in the European Union Youth Orchestra if they need something doing. For example, I went to Moldova a few months ago because the orchestra was playing there, and all the other people from the senior management of the EUIO were otherwise engaged, and they said, look, we need somebody to represent the orchestra and to go there and to make a speech. Would you like to go to Moldova? Well, what a silly question. So, of course, it is. So I do that from time to time, and I'm not involved... Others, well, actually, I'm on the board of the Kathleen Ferrier Award. But I'm always welcome to the Wigmore Hall. I'm always welcome at the Barbican. I'm incredibly lucky, and I see and hear a lot of music, and life wouldn't be the same if I didn't.
Do you think London is, in Europe, the culture-wise, since you've been across so much of it, the best capital to live in?
Yes, I think it is. I mean, I rather envy Berlin with its four opera houses. And it does have the greatest orchestra. But for the rest, you know, the things that you do any week. I mean, I've got a list of exhibitions which I still haven't seen.
I know. I get FOMO.
Yes, I've always had FOMO. I'm in favour of fear of missing out. Yep. I'm hard to get into that. It's a good impulse still to have, as one gets older, that you don't say, well, I'm bored, I don't want to see that. You don't say, why haven't I seen that?
Yeah. I mean, I think with age comes appreciation, you know, because there's a lot about London that I think is incredibly difficult for young people. You know, it's very, very expensive, it's very, very big, they're being pushed donut style to the edges and all the rest of it. But the culture, I mean, music is one thing, but look at our museums and the fashion, you know, we're pretty good at all that.
Yes, yes.
The theatres.
I know, if you can afford to get in. But yes, and you know, there you go to the non-West End theatres, places like the Donmar, like the Alameda, like the Hampstead Theatre, and there's a whole range of absolutely affordable theatres doing the highest quality work, and pub theatres and things. Yeah. London is just great. Mm.
Mm. Do you go back to Czechoslovakia ever?
Yes, I do. I was back there about a year ago, and I went with some architects. And so the architects had arranged a trip which included the Bata hometown. And actually, I was back only a few months ago to see the opening of the Dvořák home village and the Dvořák house, which the Lobkovich family have restored. And there was a concert in the courtyard of the Lobkovich palace there. And the students of the Prague Conservatoire played the New World Symphony.
Oh.
And as far as I was concerned, nunc dimittis. That was it. I will never, ever go to hear it again, because that was it. Dvořák in the Dvořák's village, in the place where he was brought up. So,
did you cry?
Yes. Quite a lot.
Good. And did you still speak Czech with a completely Czech accent? Because it was just rather surprising, but apparently you do.
Yes, I'm told that although the language that I use and the words that I use are a bit startling to anybody grown up, but that I do actually sound Czech.
So what else are you doing apart from this podcast, or is that the main event, the exciting
well,
main
that's,
event?
That's the exciting one, and I'm continuing with my Substack diaries.
That's right, yes.
Which I wrote journals about what's going on in the arts world from 2007 to 2013. It was after I left the Barbican, and I just wanted a way of keeping in touch with all the things we were doing. And I just wrote for myself. I wrote about 750,000 words and just put them to one side. And then more recently, I thought, can I do something with this? And somebody suggested Substack. So about every 3 or 4 weeks, I put out 3,000 words about what I am, was seeing and doing. It's now almost 20 years ago. And then about almost a year ago, I thought, why aren't I writing about what I'm doing now? Mm. So I'm also doing that. So I'm calling it Reflections of an Aging Art Junkie. and I shall start putting that out in about a year's time.
How exciting. And meanwhile, the podcast continues.
I certainly hope so.
Does it go out once a week? Is it a regular slot for people to look out for?
It's posted, if that's the word, weekly.
Well, how wonderful. I can't recommend it highly enough. It's really, really interesting. And thank you so much for being on Radio Oldie.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with fellow oldies. By the way, can I share with you my word, which is a collective noun for people in their 90s? Somebody said it was nonies. I said it's not. The collective noun should be the non-entities. Diary of a non-entity.
Yes.
Brilliant. I'll write it.
Brilliant. You're good. Good. Thank you so much.
Lovely. Thank you very much indeed.
You've been listening to me, Charlotte Metcalf, in conversation with John Tusa. If you've enjoyed listening to us and would like to hear more like this, please go to theoldie.co.uk, where you'll also be able to subscribe to the magazine. Meanwhile, my very, very warm thanks to you, John Tusa, to Bailey Gifford for sponsoring us, and to you for listening. Goodbye. You've been listening to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Oldie magazine for just £1? I'm sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.